I'm Tom, and I'm a criminal defense attorney.
And I'm Chris, and I'm a true crime fan.
And this is Room for Innocence.
So this is January 28th of 2015 on the Stanford College campus. It's 1 o'clock in the morning, and two graduate students from Sweden, Peter Lars Johnson and Carl Friedrich Arndt, were bicycling across the campus, and they noticed something unusual. They noticed a man and a woman engaged in some kind of sexual act next to a dumpster, which, I mean, it's alarming right away. Why would people be engaging in a sexual act next to a dumpster?
Listen, you know, people get freaky, people get drunk. The whole dumpster thing is inflammatory. You know, you think of the dumpster, you think of the kids in school skipping class, smoking cigarettes behind the dumpster. Like,
I don't know about it being inflammatory, but definitely gross. Like, I think of a dumpster, it's disgusting. I mean,
it's not romantic.
It's beyond gross. Like, there's got to be just like trash and like spilled old stuff, and
it's no girl's dream when she's getting ready for the evening to go out and, you know, get laid by the dumpster.
Yeah.
Well, maybe the one guy's probably like, hey, Lars, check it out, you know? And what do they see though?
They stop, they take a second look, and they see this guy on top of this gal thrusting. They see a thrusting motion, and it's not just once. I mean, it's over and over. So they, you know, they think they know what they're seeing. And from a bit of a distance, one of them says, hey, hold on a second. There is something not right about this. There's something not right with that woman. And they stop and look, and they realize that she is not moving, that she appears to be unconscious.
Okay.
So one of them yells out, what the F are you doing? And the guy stands up and takes off running. So they chase him down and tackle him to the ground and pin him there. And he's laughing.
Right. So they see this, they tackle him, and then
a bystander calls authorities, who arrive and arrest the man for suspicion of attempted rape. The victim was indeed unconscious. In fact, when paramedics arrived and shaked her and shouted at her, they call it the shake and shout method of testing, you know, whether somebody can be revived. They shook her by the shoulders and shouted at her. Nothing. She did not come to. She didn't regain consciousness until 4:15 in the morning in the hospital, more than 3 hours later, having no memory of the assault.
I keep wanting to jump in as a defense attorney and say what I would be saying if I was going through this evidence and crafting a defense is, sure, clearly she was passed out, but you would have to craft something here where she was, and this is what the defense did, but you have to craft something where she's conscious. And what I would say is, if you're unconscious, there's always a point just before that when you're still conscious. And who knows when that actually is. That could have been as the Swedish people were actually the Swedes, the graduate students, who are, you know, intelligent, observant people driving by, seeing what's going on. She could have been conscious right up to the point that they came around the corner. She could have lost consciousness right then. You know, if they were having sex, because he said that he asked her if she was okay with it, and she replied, uh-huh. Maybe that happened as that second happened. And, you know, he's super drunk, and he didn't realize it at that second. And it was pretty much right then that these people are yelling at him. That could have all happened right then. I mean, that might be all bullshit. That's one thing you'd have to do, I think.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, that could become a question of fact, right? For a jury to decide if they believe that that could happen. Because I hear that and I'm like, poppycock, that she was conscious and conveniently and coincidentally lost consciousness right when the eyewitnesses showed up and didn't regain consciousness for 3 hours. But to your point, there's a moment where you lost the consciousness. And it could have been that moment.
That's something I would explore that. This is really tough because these people were both wasted. Clearly the defense is going to go with that.
Well, was she tearing his clothes off and, you know, trying to have sex with him? No, she was laying there motionless. So being wasted and being with another person who's wasted does not mean that you are entitled to that person's body.
No, I think we all agree. And I think everybody else can agree. Everybody. If you are conscious and making decisions and you have intercourse with somebody who you know is passed out or mentally incapacitated, you are doing the wrong thing. That is malum in se. Like malum in se versus malum prohibitum. Malum prohibitum means it's wrong just because the law says it's wrong. So you can't go over 55 miles an hour because that's the law. But then tomorrow they change it to 65 miles an hour. Everybody's okay with it because it's only wrong because the law says it's wrong, as opposed to malum in se. It's malum just because it exists, murder. There's no law where that's okay.
Right. No civilized society would allow that behavior.
Right.
I guess then the question becomes, you said something like if you're awake and able to make decisions or something, you know? So I guess the question becomes, was he awake enough to be able to make decisions? If someone assaults me, it is because of them, not because of me. No matter what I was wearing, no matter what I had to drink, if I am assaulted, the responsibility is 100% on the assaulter. Having sexual intercourse with someone who's unconscious is assault. So I just don't think it matters that he was drunk.
No, I mean, that's correct. It doesn't matter.
And so my question for a defense attorney is, I don't know, just morally and ethically, what do you try to get from this? Do you go into this being like, I want to prove that he didn't actually assault her?
Well, so that comes to what they charged him with.
There's rape of an intoxicated person, rape of an unconscious person. Those two charges were dropped because in California, rape specifically meant genitalia, and witness accounts were that his pants were up and there was no DNA. So there was no evidence that a rape had occurred by that definition. But there were three other charges, and each of these are felony charges. Sexual penetration by a foreign object of an unconscious woman, sexual penetration by a foreign object of an intoxicated woman, and assault with intent to commit rape. And the foreign object in this case is a finger. Okay, carry on.
The FBI had updated their definition of rape, I believe, since this case happened, but the FBI, the definition is penetration, no matter how slight, of the vagina or anus with any body part or object, or oral penetration by a sex organ of another person without the consent of the victim. So under the FBI's current definition, what they proved against him would be rape, would be a rape charge. But here it was this other thing, penetrating with a foreign object.
Yeah.
Right up to this point, this kid is, you know, an up and comer. Good looking at going to the Olympics. I mean, who is this kid? I mean, he's really somebody who seems like he's going to go places in life. He's got a lot going for him.
He has a lot going for him. He's at Stanford on a scholarship, on a swimming scholarship. He's an Olympic hopeful. He's hoping to make the 2016 Olympics. There's a whole lot about this story that we're not going to really talk about, but there are plenty of other podcasts and things that do talk about these aspects of the story, and they're disturbing and interesting. Things like, after the assault occurred, an article written in a newspaper about the assault allegations, you know, it talked about the assault allegations, and then it started to talk about his swimming career, and it actually included his swimming times. So, okay, I understand that he's a promising young man who's an Olympic hopeful swimmer, but talking about his times, that's too much. You're now trying to make him sound impressive or too impressive for this to be real or something. And that's just really disturbing. And then the other thing that I heard about is articles that were written shortly after the assault showed a picture of Brock Turner, and they used his really attractive yearbook picture.
Yes. Yeah, I was going to mention that. Everyone else gets a mugshot.
And he has a mugshot. And it's not great because it's a mugshot. And that's the picture that should be used when somebody is, I mean, that is, I shouldn't even say that's the picture that should be used. That is the standard picture that gets used in these situations.
And I'm glad you kind of cleared that up. You're correct. That's the standard picture that's always used. Should it be the picture used? You're innocent until proven guilty. There's a whole bunch of ways you can go into that. But the standard is to show the mugshot. But this kid gets his, this real nice photo of him because dang it, he's going places.
Okay. So we go to trial March 14th, 2016. And like I said before, it was an unusual trial because the victim, oh, I should mention now, her name is Chanel Miller. And at the time of all of these events, she was referred to by the media and throughout the trial as Emily Doe, because a sexual assault victim has a right to privacy and their privacy is respected. Since this time, I think in 2019, she publicly shared her identity. And so I'm going to go ahead and call her Chanel Miller throughout this, but most podcasts and articles and everything else that you will read will say Emily Doe because they were done prior to her revealing her identity. It was unusual in that the victim, Chanel Miller, had no recollection of the events. So only Brock Turner was able to provide a side of the story. And his story was that the encounter was consensual, that he had her verbal consent, and that she was conscious the entire time.
Maybe he is telling the truth. He asked her if she liked it. She said, uh-huh.
I do think the eyewitness accounts where they were actively engaged at the point where the guys were saying, wait a second, she is not conscious, she's not moving. I think that's probably some of the best evidence that his story is incorrect about her being conscious the whole time.
That part doesn't scare me, but the part that I did not, that I think would be tough is when he ran. I would be nervous about him running away. That's a piece of evidence that I really don't like. That just shows guilt. Like the state could take that and run away with it. They can, you know, he saw it, he ran. He literally ran. If he stayed put, you know, maybe it would sound better. The running does not help. The running does not help.
He had a story for that. His story was that he's on the ground with her, having this sexual encounter, and he felt like he needed to throw up. So he stood up, and there were these two angry Swedish guys yelling at him. And so he ran because they were yelling at him. He wasn't sure why. So that's his story to try to explain away the running. There are two facts that the jury needs to determine, I think. The prosecution wants to say there was no consent, and the defense wants to say that there was consent. And then the prosecution wants to say that she was unconscious, and the defense wants to say that she was conscious.
Right.
And so like you said, these are the, you know, this is the story that you can tell. And then the jury just gets to decide who's more believable.
Exactly. So it always, every criminal case comes down to this. Was a crime committed? Who committed the crime? Brock Turner committed the action. We don't know if it's a crime, but whatever it was that happened, it was Brock Turner. The question is, did he commit a crime? So then again, you know, I guess there, yeah, you have to break it down. How do you determine if he committed a crime? And the large part of that is, you know, did she consent? Just if she's unconscious, then no, the answer is no. If she's unconscious, she did not consent.
Right. She may never have provided consent. If she did, in fact, provide consent, that consent was withdrawn if she had become unconscious.
Yes. So this is a very interesting case. It's not just like super, super, super clear cut.
One other fact is that Chanel Miller left a voicemail for her boyfriend shortly before the assault. And in this voicemail, she is incoherent, which is further evidence that she was not in a position to consent at that time. If when she left that voicemail, which is before she started being physical with Brock Turner, and she was incoherent, then a jury is going to have a tough time thinking that after that, she provided, you know, consent, And by the way, when I say provide consent, I think everyone knows this, but I don't mean like, do you provide consent? Yes, I provide consent. But yes, you do want to be really clear that you're both on the same page.
You know, I'm breaking this whole thing down. I'm trying to give him the benefit of the doubt with consent, this and that, building reasonable doubts, et cetera, et cetera. I just don't buy really the, you know, well, she was drunk. You know, you can tell, like, I just know when you're with somebody, you're like, this person is not this person anymore.
So you're making the point that, let's be real, when somebody is super duper drunk, you know.
Yeah.
If you can't tell, I mean, come on, you can tell. Now, an expert witness came in for the defense, somebody who specializes in blackouts, alcohol blackouts. Has done a bunch of research on blackouts.
A bunch of personal research. I'm working tonight. Yeah. With a bottle of Jack Daniels and, oh my God.
She testified that people can be in a blackout state and still engage and seem lucid. A blackout state means that you don't store memories.
Okay, right. Yeah, sure.
But you can engage and seem lucid at the time. And somebody who's with you cannot tell that you're in a blackout state. You yourself will only know that you were in a blackout state later when you realize you're missing memories.
Yeah.
I think that's very interesting.
Sure. We're talking about the graduate students coming around on their bikes. They see what's happening. If, according to my, you know, Hail Mary defense, if she had been conscious up to that point, she probably had entered that memory blackout stage long before then.
Exactly. I guess what they're trying to assert is that she could have been in a blackout state, but still seemed into what they were doing and providing consent.
Absolutely. She may very well have said, you know, yes, this is great, more, you know, and
right.
Has no idea that this happened.
Because she says, I never provided consent. Okay. So I guess that expert witness's point is she may have and not remember it, because a blackout state doesn't mean you're unconscious. You are conscious. You are active. You are talking to people. You are engaged. You are just not storing memories. So you don't remember the things you did. So saying that you didn't provide consent, you may have.
Absolutely. And here's the thing. I mean, if she's unconscious, then, you know, guilty.
Game over.
I mean, it's just whatever. And I'm a defense attorney and I'm here for you, but that's just the way it is.
So you have the defense saying, well, maybe she provided consent and just doesn't remember because she was in a blackout state. But then you have the prosecution playing this voicemail she left for her boyfriend where she is clearly completely incoherent. This is before the encounter with Brock Turner. So no, she was not somebody who was lucid and engaged. She was incoherent.
Sure. Right.
And the jury, that's their decision that they get to make, what story do I believe? And that voicemail, it's super interesting because if she had not tried to call her boyfriend and left him that voicemail, the jury might have questioned.
Right.
That voicemail was a big deal for the prosecution.
And you know that she was in between, however drunk she was when she left that voicemail, she was between that and passing out. And she was moving in the passing out direction, only getting worse.
The case went to the jury. And on March 30th, 2016, Brock Turner was found
guilty
of 3 felonies.
Yep. Bye. And now this is the great part, right? 2 to 14 is what he was supposed to get. I'm right about that.
I don't remember. 2 to 14 sounds right.
Yes.
Assault with intent to rape an intoxicated woman. And then the sexually penetrating an intoxicated person and an unconscious person. Those are considered 2 different things. So he gets these 3 felonies. Prosecutors recommended that Turner be given a 6-year prison sentence. What do you think about that?
You know, there's attorney Tom and there's civilian Tom. All right. And attorney Tom, I have to take a different stance on things, much as the same way I explained to a jury, they have to think about this case in a different way than they generally think about things. You know, just I have to somewhat do that as a defense attorney to, you know, be on a sort of broader and more conceptual as an individual. I have the way I feel about things. and Citizen Tom, things like rape, I just find particularly reprehensible. I do not care at all that you were going to a fancy school, that you were going to go to the Olympics, et cetera. When you get out, you're going to be a registered sex offender. Okay. But there's people out there going to prison for lots of things that they don't deserve to go for. So until we kind of fix a lot of the problems that we have in the judicial system, I'm not going to get up in arms about a rapist being sent to prison for 6 years.
Thank you, Citizen Tom. Now, what does Attorney Tom think?
I would be arguing for the least amount of time that I could possibly get him.
How, and this is what our listeners want to know, how do Citizen Tom and Attorney Tom live in the same body?
Well, I don't have a problem with that, and I don't think about it much. It's not something I have to struggle with. You know, it's not like I have, you know, both the light and the dark side of the force fighting within me.
I just find it really fascinating that, you know, Citizen Tom thinks, yeah, 2 to 14 years or 6 years, totally. Now, when Attorney Tom stands up and tries to get the lightest sentence possible for his client, I don't know. This is what people really struggle with.
Sure.
How do you do that when your principles, your values, and your morality is something else besides what you're fighting for your client for?
That's a great question. And I love talking about things like that. Morally and ethically, it doesn't bother me a bit. It has to be done. If you don't have a strong defense built into the system, then it's just a joke. You know, you go back to John Adams representing the soldiers at the Boston Massacre. They were the other side. He was a revolutionary. They were the Boston soldiers, and they shot and killed unarmed civilians, and he represented them. And his position was that everybody deserves the best defense that they can get. And I think that that's fair, because if you don't have a good defense, then you're not called upon to have a good prosecution, and a prosecution that's going to be checked and not literally allowed to do things that are illegal. There will at least be watchdogs to some extent, you know, protecting your rights. And how do we work together? It's very easy for me to compartmentalize. All I know is this kid got 6 months and he only served 3. Okay. Now, I've only been in Florida. That's the only place I've ever practiced law. And I'll tell you what, nobody's getting out with 6 months on a charge like this.
But Tom, he was a really fast swimmer.
I know. But, you know, listen, maybe these cases go away on a different level up here.
But Tom.
Yeah.
His yearbook picture was really cute.
He's a cute guy, you know, but I'm not going to get up in arms about this guy going to prison, because there's other bigger problems. There are other people in prison who don't need to go there, and the criminal justice system is just running amok.
Right.
This particular case, I'm sorry, doesn't get me bent out of shape as far as this guy going to prison.
So I said the prosecutors recommended 6 years. The Santa Clara County probation officials, I don't even know what that is, but they get to recommend a sentence also. And they recommended a moderate sentence with formal probation due to his lack of criminal history, youth, and expression of remorse. By the way, his expression of remorse was poopy.
It sucked. And her statement was really good.
Yeah.
And his was crap.
His statement was terrible. It was terrible. She gets up and reads this 7,000 word victim impact statement. Her statement was really powerful about the impact that this all had on her. Not just what he did to her, but the experience of going through this trial and having everything in her life dug up and questioned, and her character questioned. And then Brock Turner's father gave a statement on his behalf where he made a really dumb comment that will hopefully follow him around for the rest of his life. He said that he felt the recommended 6 years would be, quote, a steep price to pay for 20 minutes of action out of his 20 plus years of life.
Yeah. That a statement like that could even make it into your initial rough draft. Like, did you would actually write that down and or keep that thought and present that to a judge?
And think that somebody would find that compelling.
That's okay. Like,
that was the wrong thing to say on a lot of levels. Summarizing Brock's behavior as 20 minutes of action.
No.
Action.
I would choose to summarize his behavior with the FBI's updated definition, and that is rape. So 20 minutes of rape. Look, I mean, I'm a defense attorney for a lot of reasons. I love the challenge, and I just love all the aspects of being a defense attorney. But at the same time, I mean, you know, I really think there are some people who think that, like, I like criminals. I don't like criminals. Like, I'm fine with the law coming in and dealing with you if you're going to do something like that. I think there's a lot of sentencing schemes that are wrong. I think there are people who are being locked up in the wrong fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And we could go on forever about just, you know, just the new Jim Crow and just all the reasons there's all different kind of people sitting in prison. And it's fascinating, but like at the same time, like I am also I'm sensitive to victims. And, you know, like when we went camping, we go camping now and then, and we'll go to Springs, and they're out in Central Florida. And after you've been driving out west for a while, you get into the middle and you'll start passing the prisons. They just look like little industrial buildings, but these are the prisons. And this is where we put people. And there are people out there. And I was watching something one time, and a security guard for a prison was saying, you know, my job is to store people, and I warehouse them here and I keep track of them.
In cages.
There are people out there who, this is citizen Tom, and you know, there are people out there who need to be in these cages. There definitely are. You know, there's people who don't need to be. So I definitely like getting in there and mixing it up. But when it comes to like sexual assault and things like that, if you rape people, you need to go. You know, I don't even know what the right sentence is. I just think this is crazy. Let's just bring it back into reality. 2 to 14, and this kid got 6 months. How did that happen?
Right. The judge sentenced Brock Turner to 6 months in the Santa Clara County Jail.
Yeah, and he only did 3.
Right. He was released after 3 months. People were super unhappy with this judge, and voters actually recalled him as a judge.
Exactly. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Which
doesn't happen.
He was the first judge to be recalled by voters in California in 86 years and the first in the United States since 1977. The publicity of this case definitely drew attention to the fact that this guy got off too easy.
That said, you know, he does have sex offender registration for life, and that's rough. I mean, that if he didn't have that, it would be a much harder pill to swallow. That does have to bring some solace. I mean, like, sex offender registration is very hard to get through, and he's going to have to deal with that. And you know what? Good. Because, you know, sorry, Charlie.
Yeah.
And now I looked him up, and he's got a job, you know, he's just doing his job. Seems like it's an entry level job. He's not making a lot of money at all. And they say he just kind of shows up, does his job, keeps to himself, goes home. So he's nowhere where he would have been. Like, he was on his way. Imagine he would have done really well, even if he didn't make it to the Olympics. I mean, you know, squared away, forward moving.
Mm-hmm. Stanford graduate.
Yeah, nice degree. Going to know all the right people. And he'd be making tons of money, even if he was just garden variety for whatever garden he was going to be growing in. He was going to be doing pretty well. And now he's not. Now he's just, you know, he's got a schmuck life, and that's just a warning.
That's right.
Let this guy just be a warning to the rest of you, you know, like, mm-hmm. Don't be a jerk.
At this point, nobody can claim ignorance. And the fact that he got off with a 6-month sentence that he only served 3 months of.
Oh, that's a shame.
It's tragic considering how much, God, these people, like Chanel Miller, having to sit through this questioning and this cross-examination about every aspect of her life. If someone told her he was just going to go to jail for 3 months, she might've just been like, forget it.
You know, that's the thing. I mean, there's statistics out there that show, you know, for every like 1,000 rapes, if you'll call it that, it's like 25 guys actually are found guilty, and the rest, you know.
Well, let's even just say that all 1,000 of them, or you know, 995 of them, are valid claims. We still just can't incarcerate people and convict people without evidence.
I know it's a terribly touchy situation. It's something that people have to be very scared about. Like, because this is always going to be behind closed doors. I mean, you know, just as it's easy for a guy to get away with raping a girl because he doesn't leave any physical evidence and all you have is he said, she said, it's just as easy for a woman to falsely accuse a man. Because at the end of the day, you're in court and all you have is the evidence, which is most of the time only going to be somebody saying something. And that's difficult. And, especially from a prosecutorial view, because I've handled many sex cases and rape allegations, and I've done a good job. And I've said, I think all of the sex cases I've had that have gone to trial, I know there's one that I got found, that was the guy was found guilty, but I've won a lot of them. Okay. I've definitely won a lot. If you didn't have these eyewitnesses, these grad students, I don't think you would have a case here.
Right.
Regardless of what the truth is. You know, if you didn't have an eyewitness.
Yeah. You said just something a second ago about behind closed doors, something like, well, they're all behind closed doors. I'm like, yeah, except the ones that are next to the dumpster.
Yeah.
And that's where, you know, you get the eyewitnesses. But, you know, some people might hear you say, you know, most of your sex cases have been not guilties, and they might not feel that that's a victory because the victim didn't get justice.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I just wanted to point out that, you know, let's say that all of those claims were valid, that all of those victims were victims. And so is it a victory when there's a not guilty? Well, not for that victim, obviously.
Right. No.
But we can't convict and incarcerate people without evidence.
No, you can't. And I have to just kind of bring this up. Seems like a really good opportunity, but I've had, you know, a good amount of sex cases. And it's always, you know, when you win, you're like, hey, I did a good job. And you want to do a good job. At the end of the day, I just want to feel like I'm doing my job and I take my job seriously and I take the whole justice system seriously. And one thing I look at is, well, if I set a guilty man free, it's because the state didn't do their job. You know, there's different ways to, you know, think about it. I don't have to ever actually validate it though, because I believe in what I do.
Yeah.
I mean, it's if I don't do it, then it's not there. And then you're just living in, you know, some sort of like horror book, like Kafka or George Orwell or something strange like that. You have to have a valid defense.
Okay. Last point. You mentioned this earlier. Chanel Miller wrote a book called Know My Name, a memoir, in which she revealed that she was Emily Doe.
I heard she wrote so well that, like, during some point in the publishing or the writing of it, like, there was some agent swapping or something because somebody was read some bits of it and they were like, wow, like, she actually writes well. And as a reader, I'll say that I love good writing.
Her victim impact statement is beautifully written, too.
I thought so.
Yeah.
I might read this book.
Mm-hmm.
Other people out there who are listening to us who feel the same way know what I'm saying. But like when something's written well, I like to read it.
Yes, Tom. They also like Gillian Flynn.
I was thinking about her while I said that, you know, yeah.
Yeah, it's that's why we chose to use her real name, as we said in the beginning, because she has put that out there and said, I want you to know my name.
And hopefully this helps everybody. Hopefully it helps guys make the right decision. And hopefully it helps women out to some extent. Everybody go out. Everybody have a good time. And you know what? You should be able to go out and get drunk. You know, yes, you should be able to. And no, you should not be assaulted. But
no,
but you just need to understand that at that point, you're just throwing caution and luck to the wind. Just be careful. And guys, same thing. You go out there and you get drunk, you're going to do something stupid and you're going to get in trouble. And, you know, you should have known better.
It's hard to say because people will say, you know, it's victim blaming. And I've heard people say, when are we going to stop teaching women all the ways to avoid getting raped and start teaching men not to rape women? And I agree. I could not agree more. But we do have to continue to teach women how to avoid these situations because the only person you can control is yourself. You can't control what someone else is going to choose to do.
No, you can't.
Who's responsible for it? The attacker is the only one at fault, but you cannot control if that person is out there waiting to attack you. And if you did put yourself in that position, it doesn't make it your fault.
No, they still shouldn't do it. They should still not touch you. Absolutely not. They should not. And it is not your fault. You should be able to get drunk and pass out in the corner and wake up and nobody put their fucking hands on you. Absolutely.
That's right. But do you really want to be sitting around talking about whose fault it is?
Yeah, I'll just wrap it up with this one last thing here. You don't want to be on the winning side of a lawsuit. I don't want to win money because something terrible happened to a member of my family. You know, just try to think ahead. But, you know, all that said, you know, I think we've made the point really clear. Keep your hands to yourself and just remain vigilant and be good.
We beat that dead horse.
We sure did, and should have known better. I saw something really interesting. If anybody's dealing with this kind of thing or they're just curious about it. Ah, there it is. RAINN. It's like RAINN with two N's, RAINN. So RAINN.org. And RAINN is Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network. And they just have a lot of great information. So, I mean, if it's something that you're curious about for whatever reason, I would suggest jumping onto that site. They just have lots of great stuff. If you need some kind of help, you know, they have links with that, public policy laws in your state. Lots of different links on statistics, types of violence, understanding consent, and reading up on all the issues similar to what we've been talking about. So if you're trying to figure out if something that happened to you or someone you know, if you're trying to figure out how that falls in to sexual abuse laws, definitely check out this site.
Okay, that's great. We can put a link to that in our show notes too. Well, let's close it out.
Yeah. This has been a good one.
Thanks for lending us your legal insight. And
absolutely.
I know it's tough when I'm like, how can you do that when you're a decent person? But I think that a lot of people have these questions and I think they'll find your answers really interesting about how you do that.
I hope so. And keep listening because we'll keep talking about it. But it's just all part of the system. And you know, that's one thing we don't talk about enough, or is just how the system works, the adversarial system, two parties that, you know, represent opposite interests, but somehow are supposed to end up working together.
We talked about that in our first episode, Gideon versus Wainwright. So if people are interested in learning about that and why the Supreme Court found it so important for every accused person to have a lawyer, is because of what you're talking about. Somebody has to do it.
Somebody's got to do it. Check out that Gideon versus Wainwright episode. That one covers all of that.
Yeah. Thanks, Tom.
I'm Tom.
And I'm Chris. And the defense rests.